Will you all please take your seats? Charles Brown is next. I was going to say that as a long-time member of and contributor to Philsoft and twice its chairman, everybody must know Charles.
But then I discovered one person
who's also been a long-time member who doesn't straighten it yet. His talk is entitled, A New God is Necessary. Is this one sufficient? He's a sympathetic critic of Anne's work, liking her scientific approach to morality, and having some doubts about its practicability and desirability. But being particularly interested in moral philosophy, it's appropriate that he should be the one to consider the ethical issues raised by Anne's bold concept of moral science. Charles.
You'll have gathered from what Anne was saying just how big, how huge a book this is, and just not physically in terms of 461 pages, but every page, every chapter is packed with concepts, many, many of which are brand new and well worth reading. My talk will not cover the same ground as Anne. It will overlap slightly with it, but I'm hoping that will help to give you a view of another bit of the book. I'll press on because time is short, there's a lot to cover. We'll be question time at the end. So if something I say and you don't like it very much, sit on your hands till the end. Some of the things I say, there's a handout here which all of you have got. The handouts cover more than I will be saying. And the result is that some of the things I say could have more explanation, that for some of them may appear sort of somewhat deafening. And also some of them I'm hoping will be provocative, so that if not today, at least at the Philsoft review and the website, we may have some interesting talk to carry on with. Philosophy and science, I've started off by saying here, are our main methods of understanding the world. The main reason we want to do that is so that we can make use of the world. We're beginning to realize that that's not altogether perhaps an ideal thing. Philosophy's main concern, and I'm putting this I'm aiming this in the context of Anne's book, is two basic questions. What's the nature of the world and how can we know that nature? And secondly, what things exist and happen? What things that exist and happen really matter? Which are valuable ethically and or aesthetically? And how do we decide? So that's a particular sort of view of philosophy that I'm taking, so that it sort of fits in with what Anne and I, and perhaps Anne and Bailey, have to say. Notice there, value is absolutely fundamental at the heart of the whole thing. Anne said that what she's looking for is absolute value. So value at the beginning, and we will end up perhaps with value at the end. Will we end up with absolute value? Well, that's largely what I'm talking about. Science is primarily about explanation via hypotheses and evidence. I think that Anne uses fewer hypotheses and has two main items, which are persons and equality, absolute equal equality. I think are in fact predictions more than they are hypotheses. For the last 30 plus years, the time more or less when I've been coming here, philosophy has increasingly been affected by science. Several people I've spoken to who are re-entering philosophy after many years from having done maybe undergraduate philosophy expressed surprise at re-entering that it was so scientific nowadays, and that's true. I don't consider that a disadvantage. I think it's a huge advantage, because it enables us to do a lot more in philosophy than the narrow keyhole view that existed in the middle of the 20th century. Michael Lockwood, I think, is an ideal example in his book of 3 years ago on time is an ideal example. Michael Lockwood is a distinguished philosopher who recognized very early in his life that he needed to study science, otherwise he was looking at the world through this narrow keyhole. So he's done that. And he doesn't hesitate to take knowledge from wherever it comes, from science or whatever, even if it's only a matter of probability. He's not seeking certainty, for example. He will put in logical, conceptual clarification where that needs to be done, and he's not afraid to make a new conjecture if it's necessary, which is anathema to most linguistic philosophers, I think, in my experience anyway. Now, Anne's book follows a similar general pattern in that she is a long-term psychologist, who has recognized that philosophy is necessary for her to understand the world as she wants to. So she has done the same as Michael, coming from the other direction. And that's one of the things that makes her book so comprehensible and readable. I find it very, very interesting. I've learned a lot from it, both science and about the philosophy. But she's talking about moral science, not moral philosophy. And she backs it up with what she calls philosophical conversation, not empirical observation. So in that sense, I think it isn't conventionally purely scientific. It's a mixture of philosophy and science, somewhat indeterminate mixture. As I said, she's making predictions rather than hypotheses, and therefore I can't really comment on the predictions, because she says it may well take a couple of thousand years for these to come to pass. Well, how do I know what the situation may be in a couple of thousand years? And her fully human humans who exist at that time, superior to us beyond understanding, what they will value is what conceptual repertoires they'll have in their heads, we don't know. So I'm not going to try to prejudge that, nor does Anne, because she says, well, she'll leave the future people to make these decisions as to what equality actually constitutes. So I'm going to look at it through the only way I can, which is not of I is fully human humans, but mere I am animal humans that I and most of us are today. Because it's the only way I can look at it. Alan Bailey, who's speaking this afternoon, will critique Anne's philosophy. And philosophy, in particular, from the point of view of persons. So I don't intend to talk about persons at all. I intend to talk about the science side of what Anne said. But I'll only be able to cover two or three relatively small points. Remembering where we're starting off here, traditionally, without the traditional God, has to have absolute value, has to have universal values. There must be in this God an absolute fixed moral foundation. That's what his job was. We've ended up now, because the alternative is where we are larger after it is relativism, where one value may well be as good as another. Anne's book is a seeking and a defense of absolute value, and we test her book by seeing to what extent she has achieved that at the end. She's making a replacement for God, and she says that, quote, just is the human enterprise. Does Anne define or explain values? No. Those of you who were here a few weeks back, remember the guys on the platform were asked to define value, and they were really struggling. They couldn't do it. Is her replacement for God, in terms of absolute value and absolute equality, like the God of theism, intrinsically good? He has to be intrinsically good, good in himself. So the replacement for God will have to be intrinsically good, good in itself, if it's going to provide the same justification for acting morally. It doesn't have to be just another means, an instrument, towards something else. Does Anne do that? In my opinion, no, she doesn't. My first main particular doubt is about the concept of absolute equality. We're all liberals nowadays. We all intuit less inequality as a good thing. But complete absolute equality brings me to a grinding halt. My intuition say no, And I've spoken to quite a few people, and they've said no. I remember 25 years ago, when the SDP was being formed in Britain, it was the first attempt in modern times to construct a constitution for a brand new liberal centre-left party. And all these things were looked at very carefully. And I can remember absolute equality being addressed. And it was by no means accepted by a majority of people. Greater equality, less inequality, but absolute equality, big question mark. But Anne has a highly developed social conscience, as you probably gathered. She is an intuitive egalitarian socialist. So to her, absolute equality, as you've heard, is simply self-evidently correct. Equality of what? Anne doesn't say exactly. As I said, she leaves it to the future persons to work out nearer the time, a couple of thousand, perhaps, years in the future. And you can ask today, is it material resources? Yes. Is it health? Happiness? Beauty? Intelligence? It seems to me that absolute equality would seem perhaps to suggest that it's equality in every single aspect that you can think of, every nook and cranny. It seems very, very strange. Are people equally tall? Are they equally beautiful? Are they equally intelligent? She doesn't spell that out. And I think in the second edition, I'll be asking her to do so. But in 2,000 years, who knows? It may be health. We may have conquered death then. Biochemistry and genetic engineering are making such progress that who knows what the situation will be. So it may come to pass exactly as she said. It may be inevitable, inexorable. But for me, there's a hint of too much in building this equality. There's a hint of too much socialism, too much welfareism. I think too much of those always tend to, as I've written here, debilitate and infantilize the people. With absolute equality also, there could be no excellence. By definition, nobody could excel. If I put my head above the parapet, somebody's going to chop it off. That worries me. If there are no differences, no change can take place. There's nothing for natural selection, for example, to work on. So it seems to me you would get stagnation. Of course, it may be some extremely high level of stagnation, and people may be happy with it. But it worries me, looking at it through my animal-human concepts. All socialist experiments and utopias, as far as I'm concerned, have failed, and in my opinion, will continue to fail. We haven't the time to go into that much, but Russia, the terrible state of Russia, especially the insides of the heads of the Russian people today. Look at the state in Cuba. I've noticed that Castro, who's sick, he was interviewed not so long ago, and he's admitted that after him, market forces, etc., etc., modern economics will have to come in because Cuba's education system and its health system are excellent, but its economy is a basket case. But he said, I can't do it because I have to remain true to the Che Guevara's and the ones who started it. He has to remain true to the original aims of the revolution. It's for the people coming after him. But he said, yes, market forces will have to come in. I've written Scotland here as well. In my own country, there's a big worry these days that, bearing in mind what Scotland was in the 18th and 19th centuries, in terms of entrepreneurship, there's a great worry that no entrepreneurship is coming up spontaneously from the people. Mm-hmm. I mentioned debilitation, I mentioned infantilization. And if you've got a country where, in most times, 60% of the people are employed by the state, but they're time not far from my old home, where 70% of the working population are employed by the state. I saw some figures recently, I think, if I can remember accurately, that in Scotland, with a population of 5 or 6 million, there are only something like 270,000 net taxpayers. So you can see my hesitation. I think the difference is important. I'm reminded of 100 flowers blooming. I think competition's important. I think we have to provide scope for natural selection to do its work. And I think these different competition are all good. And cooperation is good, competition is bad. But of course, again, it all might be different in a couple of thousand years. her main scientific approach is determinism along with evolution. Not the identical evolution that I would use, and her determinism is as you would expect, no free will whatsoever. But for Anne, natural equals genetic. Darwinian genetics. Mutations, descent with variation, competition, again natural selection doing its job. I'm in danger of anthropomorphizing natural selection, but can we do it just as a convenient shorthand? For Anne, competition is bad, only cooperation is good. It is self-evidently good to her that the maximum good is absolute equality. That is the maximum good. There are other goods, but that is the only and maximum good. I suspect Anne, when she gets her answers, her chance later on will come at me saying that I'm distorting her point of view. I may well be. It's a very complex book. I can only see it through my eyes and through my conceptual repertoire. In terms of evolution, she thinks evolution only applies to that genetic Darwinian bit. Culture, which is where language lives, where religion lives, where politics live, where persons live, she said, doesn't evolve, as you heard me saying, it develops, which is a subtly different thing. I disagree. I think culture does evolve. It's the old nature-nurture battle. I think both evolve. Culture, if you go back long enough, we are social animals, and we became social animals, at least our remote ancestors did at a particular time. Chimpanzees are social animals, bonobos are social animals. I think the only solitary primate is the orangutan. And obviously dolphins are social, ants are social, bees are social. How did they become social? Well, again, my old friend natural selection made them so, because that's what the environment, etc., was at that time. Why did it make them so? It increases the probability of their continuing in existence. Surviving, or living, continuing to be. And that was natural. The sociality for all these creatures was a natural emergent product, thing. A product of what they intrinsically were. Why are human beings different from that? Why is their sociality not a natural emergent property? Why does it not evolve? Because natural, remember, equals genetic, equals competition, equals no cooperation, equals red in tooth and claw, equals bad. The reason Anne doesn't want culture to evolve, because that evolve may be Darwinian, it may be red in tooth and claw, so she wants to keep it out. So she keeps it out largely by stipulation and definitions. Two or three times in her book, she makes definitions which are, shall we say, slightly in her favour. Now, the first of your handbooks, of your handouts here, I'm not going to go through the whole handbook, I'm just picking up a few parts. There's a thing called gene culture co-evolution. I became aware of it 20 years ago, or so down here. I can remember a weekend here where it really discussed it. And I was somewhat surprised recently to find a few people, philosophers, you know, whose opinion I suspect, were totally unaware of it. Daniel Dennett, in his latest book, for example, he gets rid of the gene culture. He simply calls it co-evolution. So that's the first main thing that I want to highlight, is gene culture co-evolution. There we go. Keep that in mind. Daniel Dennett just calls it co-evolution. By now, in mainstream evolutionary talk, it's just taken for granted. I've said here, however, it's clear that some philosophers still consider genetic Darwinian and cultural Lamarckian evolution to be two completely separate processes, both occurring in some species together, like in humans, but without causal interaction. Some people even refuse to accept cultural change as evolutionary or even as natural on the basis that it is not genetic. I'm amazed to find that recently. That's You know, one of the reasons why it prompted me to do this thing. I've quoted in Para 2 from the New Scientist of about a year ago. It's worth going through it word by word. A basic premise of the gene-centered paradigm is that while information can be passed from genes to organisms, nothing that happens to the organism can ever affect the genes or be transmitted to future generations. Standard genetic Darwinism. In fact, in multicellular organisms, there is a level at which a form of such inheritance is rampant. The DNA code may be unchanged, but in some types of cell, differences arise in the way the genes are expressed, and they transfer the information concerning their acquired pattern of gene expression to their daughter cells. It is called epigenetic inheritance. Gene culture, co-evolution. I've put various examples in here of it's happening, but we haven't time to cover them all. For many disorders, health disorders for example, there are no single genes. The genetic component arises from the interaction of several genes with each other and with the environment. For example, it's known that genetic factors contribute to the onset of schizophrenia, but also that some other non-genetic factors, for example cultural, such as malnutrition or stress in early life, are necessary, are required. In other words, the interaction and expression of some genes is culturally determined and will vary as culture varies. Thus, a change in culture, a bit of evolution. Evolution means no more than gradual change. It doesn't mean Darwinian, it doesn't mean Lamarckian, it just means gradual change. It does not entail genetic, or even imply. Thus, a change in culture, a bit of evolution, can affect the genome, if not by altering the structure of some of the genes, then by altering how some of them interact and are expressed. Particular examples. Compared to our pre-linguistic ancestors, I think the best example is to talk about the evolution of language opinions. What was required for a language to emerge? I'll just briefly mention them. Huge growth in the brain. Redesign of the vocal cords. These are all the physical aspects. The larynx descending in the throat so that the air flow can be directed properly through it. And I think beautiful, the delay of that descent in neonates to enable them to suckle and breathe at the same time, at which point, after a decent period, when they're weaned, it descends. Isn't that beautiful? Enlargement of the nerve carrying the more complex linguistic signals to the brain, and an enlargement, again beautiful, of the hole through which it passes the bottom of the skull to get to the vocal cords. The hole actually has to get bigger. That's a powerful indication, by the way, that information is real and physical. If the more complex information requires a bigger hole. And finally, I'll put here modification of the chest muscles to give us the exquisite control of breathing necessary for speech. No other animals can do that. Chimps can't do it. Only we can do it. Over the same time period, that was the body. Over the same time period, enabled by these changes, our ancestors had also to increase the informational content of the brain, i.e. to expand the size and complexity of their conceptual repertoire. The bigger and more complex brain and the developing voice enabled them to intensify their social intercourse and their ability to interact with and control their world. So each of them had increasingly complex concepts to exchange to contribute to the new informational whole. Thus, in perhaps 100,000 years that it took complex language to develop, our ancestors underwent a huge physical and cultural evolution. The separate parts, physical and cultural, co-evolved, each in small stages and all orchestrated by natural selection. Which came first? We don't know. Probably none of them came first. What mattered was they're all travelling and arriving together, fully coordinated. Gene culture, co-evolution. Evolution of the body changes was Darwinian. evolution of the conceptual, the informational changes, was Lamarckian. Also, the body and the culture paths were strongly interdependent, mutually causal, with each small step on one path being both necessary and sufficient for a new step on the other path. This is a lovely example of natural selection at work, taking us blindly but inexorably from where we were to where we are now. I have no doubt at all that this gene culture coevolution is still going on. The epigenetic that we saw, activity that we saw at the beginning, is a good example of that. It's still going on. We are being subjected. It hasn't stopped. That's all I've got to say about gene culture coevolution. So you can see that, unlike Anne, I do not believe that evolution applies only to the Darwinian genetic. I think culture evolves as well. Evolve just means gradually changes. I'm thinking, for example, that if we take some examples of cultural evolution, take religion, for example. Remember, in the Darwinian one, you have descent with variation, and you have competition, natural selection doing its work. Down the cultural route, where we have religion, language, politics, etc., as I said, there's descent with variation. Protestant Christianity is a descent with variation of Roman Catholicism. We have competition between different parts of culture, religions. Thank goodness, do we ever have to have competition among religions, right? And variation. And through time, given time, natural selection will sort them. Some will fall by the wayside, others will survive. And you can take almost any other part of culture, and there is descent with variation, there is competition, there is natural selection. Culture and genes evolve. They are both natural and not only are they two streams, they are not two separate streams, they are two streams that converge and intermingle at every point. That's clear, I hope. Natural morality. I'm going to have to cut this very tight. But if you look at the next one, the grounds of natural morality, you'll see at the top left-hand corner the organic process, as I've written here. And I've given examples of some of what the organic process is supposed to comprise. Most important ones are self-sustaining, self-starting, and stable. When it started 3.8 or so billion years ago, a brand new natural kind came into the universe, a brand new property, and that brand new property, a new intrinsic property, was spontaneous continuance, and that differentiated it from all of our natural processes. Auto continuance is what the organic process is about. As Spinoza said in his Ethics, he said all living things seek to continue in their being. That's the definition, almost, of the organic process. Thus, all normal behavior of all organisms, including humans, is grounded in continuance. Morality, which refers primarily to human social interpersonal relations, is no exception. It is no more than a subset of that general continuous behavior. It isn't hugely special in its own right. This is important bit for Anson. Good is the name we give to the predicate has the property of probably being of some amount of instrumental utility towards the continuance of some part of the organic process. For brevity of social and or biological, which includes psychological utility, and for even greater brevity, reduced continuance to ROC, that means end at continuance. all the behavior of all organisms is grounded in that. And remember, Anne is seeking the grounds, the foundations of morality. That's what good means. Value is the name we give to the amount of utility. That is, good refers to the basic, bare fact that's of something's being of utility towards continuance, some bit of behavior, some object. And value quantifies that utility. We need quantification for practical reasoning. For example, in moral dilemmas, to assess net biological utility. You have to make a decision, that's how you do it. It's difficult, it's complex. Flourishing is the name we give to the state of maximum probability of continuance. Thus, contrary to much common usage, goodness and value are not equivalent. To attribute value is also to attribute goodness, but they are different concepts. Anne Long's book is a search for absolute value. She seeks a new idea, a replacement for the idea of God as the ground of value. Remember, that God, the God of theism, qua absolute goodness, was seen as an end in himself, not a means to something else. There was nothing else. Though Anne doesn't define or explain value, and I've noticed in her glossary she doesn't either, she intuits a close link between value and goodness, but she fails to see utility towards continuance. Not that she's unaware of it. She and I have talked over the years many times. She decides to ignore it. She doesn't see the continuance as causally connecting all three, good, value, and utility. They are all one whole, causal whole. This is hardly surprising, since something whose role is to be an instrument, a means in a process, as value is, as the quantifier of utility, it's a means in the process, in the organic process. It cannot at the same time be an end for that process. So there cannot be absolute value in any sense of being an end, being a thing in itself. Value can only be a means, can only be instrumental. So according to C theory, which is what I call this, value and goodness cannot be absolute. How would we make sense of absolute value as some amount of utility? It wouldn't make sense. How could any amount of utility towards continuance constitute an end as opposed to a means? There cannot be absolute value. Good and its many cognates, fine, proper, useful, etc., are all value words. If you can remember your RN here in the language of morals, that brings that back. The drive to act, I receive, is deeply intrinsic in all organisms. What we humans intuit about good things, action state of affairs, objects, etc., is their utility, their actual or potential usefulness as instruments, tools, means for organisms seeking to continue in their being. But perhaps the most important fact to note about good, and this is very interesting, I think, good as of instrumental utility towards organic continuance, is that it puts that continuance, the fact of organic continuance, outside the extension of good. Good is internal. That is, see itself, whether or not the organic process does continue, is just a brute fact about the universe. It is neither good nor bad. It is of neither value nor disvalue. It is simply value neutral, of no apparent utility to anything higher. Now, there's a hopeful message for you. So goodness and value exist, all right, but only as concepts inside the organic process, with reference to the fact of the existence of that process or to anything outside it. They are empty, meaningless concepts. They mean only something inside the process. I'll have to cut out a lot of good stuff. We may be able to come to it in the question section. But it must be emphasized that what we've been considering are only the grounds, the foundations of morality. We have not been trying to reduce the rest of morality, the superstructure in which we exist every day, we live every day, we function every day. Reduce it in any way. Certainly not to nothing but, in quotation marks, chemistry or whatever. Like everything else, but like everything else about us, that superstructure, our manners, mores, laws, and you can see there, 15 other things that I've mentioned which constitute that superstructure, has evolved both genetically and culturally and represents the hard end experience of countless generations of our ancestors. But they no longer do the job. Whether or not and future truly human persons agree that there is no absolute value and that this equality that Anne's talking about is not an absolute value. It is in fact, I think it's important to find a particular piece here. Anne's aim is flourishing. Fine, we've seen that flourishing is the maximum probability of continuance. She's seen that absolute equality was the aim, but absolute equality isn't an end, it's a means. A means to what? And she says that the human enterprise shall not die. And that, ladies and gentlemen, brings us absolutely straight back to continuance. What Anne's really talking about is continuance. Any natural theory of morality is bound to end up at continuance. I think I'll stop there. Thank you very much. We have time for a few questions. Yes, sir.
Charles, I agree with a lot of what you said, but I'd like to defend Anne's position regarding evolution and development.
Could you speak up a bit?
I'd like to defend Anne's distinction between evolution and development. You present this, I think you call it co-evolution, as a sort of dumb deal that everybody agrees on. That's not really true. I mean, somebody like John Dupre, for example, is radically against that. I think one has to make a distinction. I accept the idea of culture having an effect on the biological evolutionary process. That's one thing. But I'm not very clear what it would mean to talk about evolution of culture as such. And, in terms of evolution, it seems to me as a biological technical word. And just picking it up and applying it to culture seems a bit ungrounded. To start with, in biology, we would have some concept of a genotype and phenotype. What would they correspond to in a cultural context? I guess that's my question.
Well, the genotype and the phenotype are integral to it, but I think the more important point that you were talking about there was evolution. I insist that evolution does not imply or entail any mechanism, Darwinian or Lamarckian. Charles Darwin's grandfather, Erasmus Darwin, at the end of the 18th century, was well known as an evolutionist, and of course came under severe strictures from the church about it. So the fact that humans and other organisms had arrived at where they are today by a process of gradual change was widely accepted among people like ourselves at that time. What Charles Darwin did wasn't to discover evolution, he discovered the mechanism of natural selection. And that was it. But he didn't know what the mechanism was. And of course, along came Mendel at the end of the 19th century with his peas and so on, which answered part of that. And then along came Crick and Watson. And we then knew that what the mechanism of evolution was in terms of DNA, RNA, etc. But I absolutely insist that the concept of evolution means no more than gradual change. And it's part of my argument here conventional philosophy, which has been largely, having been unaware, the people I talk to have been unaware of the gene culture co-evolution, have failed to realize the loose, ordinary language in which, yes, evolution does refer to Darwinian is simply wrong, as so much of ordinary language is.
So cultural evolution awaits its Crick and Watson?
I don't know. I don't know. Can we perhaps talk about that later and give somebody else a chance? Yes.
So you would resist a teleological ending?
One of the bits I didn't say was that there is no telos. The drive to continue I call proximate push from within. There is no ultimate pull from without, from some great tracker. No. Yes, sir.
I share your skepticism about the idea of classical equality, but I had occasion, actually 2 weeks ago today.
Could you speak up a little, please?
So I had occasion just 2 weeks ago today to be talking about a memorial event to somebody who had been quite eminent in his field, and one of the points I made about him was that he never felt himself superior to anybody else, but nor did he ever think of himself as inferior to anybody else. Now that seems to me, and it may be slightly ideological, but there are people like that, they do exist, and you could, by the process, by your sort of process of cultural illusion, it is conceivable. You wouldn't get a world where a lot of people felt that way, which would be a much more equitable world, I suspect, and perhaps somewhere near the sort of ideal that Anne's.
Well, I would agree with what you said, and in that context, I would agree with what Anne said. But remember, she said that, I think that there are, certainly in the book somewhere it says, there are some people, of course, who are further along this path towards the human. Yes, so the person you're talking about was way ahead of the rest of us.
That would be a cultural evolution towards cooperation, which I accept historically is not a very good track record on, but it is conceivable that your sort of process of evolution could lead that way.
Absolutely, yes. I cannot deny a prediction.
No.
Time will tell.
Yes, I just wanted to be clear about cultural evolution, so using it, whether it's progressive, an escalator theory in some way.
Progressive.
Advances, yes. You know, looking towards the utopia of culturally determined experiences, or whether you see it as circular.
I don't know about the circle, I have to think about that.
Well, because it seems to me that Anne started with a mere quotation, which she's actually took from the Bible, who is it going to tell me what I am, and it seems to me that that play actually is about central experience, and no personic conceptualism, no personic productivism, and the development, which of course is a poetic text, so it's not for real, but the audience development was a perception of something in another world, in this world is value supreme, the only perception we have then of value towards which we're moving isn't contained in that text.
Well,
therefore, I don't see cultural evolution necessarily as progressive, but secular.
Well, in my lengthy correspondence with Anne, I took her to task on progress. And I said again, in terms of ordinary language, progress usually entails, or at least implies, towards something better. I remember Latin progredio, progredi, simply means movement from one place to another. An army can progress, make progress. It doesn't imply A that it's going to win, or B that it's fighting a moral cause. Progress does not imply good, just as evolution does not imply purely genetic change. We must, part of what I'm saying, because of the scientific side, we must begin to be far more rigorous in our definitions of these words. Lady here, yes?
Anne talked as much about increasing loving as about increasing equality, and you haven't mentioned that at all.
Yes, well, it's in here loud and clear. But we may overcome that further on. But yes, I think in the end, once we get past our own infancy, where we needed the man in the sky to to look over this. We're now in the sort of adolescent, young adult stage of things. Once our maturation is complete and we become fully adult, fully human humans that Anne is talking about, we can then live with the fact that the organic process of which we are a part, I insist we are homines sapientes, as well as persons. We will learn to live with the idea that the existence of that is merely a brute fact about the universe, and outside the organic process, absolutely nothing matters. There is no such thing as goodness or value.
Yes, but her point about equality was that it facilitated more loving. And you zeroed in on the equality without the context.
Well, the reason for that is because my friend Alan Bailey, who's speaking this afternoon, is going to talk about persons, and I'm pretty sure he will cover that. I deliberately left the huge dimension of persons.
You're disappointed, Charles.
Oh, sorry. Yes, sir.
On the question of the factuality of value, it seems to me that broad systems of value are likely to encourage sociability and thus obviously encourage continuous. But I'm not sure it quite how it presents itself to the individual. People have probably seen there's been this recent controversy among mountaineers about what you do if you find someone collapsed. Do you do what you probably turned out? Of course, that's the hazard. You take it down, they don't survive, perhaps you lose some of your party as well. Or do you say, here, I'm not human, there's a human being over there, I'm going for it, and getting them down. In this sense, it's almost a parallel between aesthetics and ethics.
I agree.
That somehow feels one wants to meet up with a person and say, I'm going for it.
That's one of the reasons I mentioned them both in my introductory remarks. But I'm deliberately trying to discipline myself to the grounds, the foundations of morality, not the superstructure.
But is the person who says there's no doubt about this, I've got to go to this person. Surely that's a fact. I mean, there's some reality there.
Yes, of course. But it isn't part of the context of what I'm trying to talk about. One of the things I excised about, for example, was that I talked about value. And I said that our values are like our rights are no more than, quote, very goods. What we have as values are the things we find to be very good. Very good being that. Our values are things we find hugely instrumental towards that. And that, remember, one of the definitions of that is social and or biological, including psychological utility. And that's what your friend, the guy you're talking about, needs to do. It's a very difficult sum, and that would take us into not theoretical reason, but practical reason, which is outside the context of today.
Probably got time for just one more question, Charles, I'm afraid.
Yes, sir.
Charles, looking at your handout, I very much like what you have to say about good and value. You then go on to say we need quantification for practical reasoning. Now, from that, I assume that you are, and you may object to this, you are a utilitarian.
Absolutely.
Yeah, because a Kantian would disagree with that totally.
I'm aware of
that. I'm sure you would accept that.
Yes. Might I suggest that, humbly, that I think Kant is wrong?
A new God is necessary. If you disagree with Anne's God, you say that's not sufficient. I wasn't clear from your thought just now what God, new God, you're going to replace.
Anne's really trying to replace God, not me. I have said a new God is necessary. Is this one and sufficient? And I'm hoping what I've said. And sufficient means, does it represent absolute goodness, absolute equality in itself as an end, like the God of theism did? And I'm saying that Anne's equality does not achieve. In fact, I'm saying because of the definition of good and so on, I've said very carefully several times, there is no such thing as absolute value. value is only instrumental as a quantifier of utility.
Where's your new goal?
I'm not making any new goal. I said here, the best we're going to do is to grow out of our childhood and come to terms with the fact that we are on spaceship Earth, and as far as we know, there aren't any others of us around in the universe. And once we realize that we've got to make this organic process work, we will realize that the single most powerful tool we have to make it work, and this is what Anne is absolutely right, is love, in every meaning of love.
Got to stop there.
Charles, thank you very much indeed. I think the bar is open. It's lunchtime now. Could I ask everyone to come? Sorry, yes.
I just want to say something about the bar being open.
Right.
In order to say thank you so much for all the blah blah blah, there you will find on your dinner table a present for you in the bottom of the table. So bear that in mind.